Well, this morning we're going to be looking at the topic of God's pleasure in his creation, in all his creation. Really excited about this for a couple of reasons. One is I just am amazed at what God has given us to look at and see in this place, this universe that he has situated us in. But I'm also really excited because we're going to have a couple of men in our body share with us about their kind of specific field of expertise they're enthused about that. So Lynn Peebles and John Snook are going to be sharing with us. I'll say a little bit about that in a minute. But before we do, I do want to just take a minute to pray for us, ask God to come and show more of himself to us in what we do here this morning. So will you join me? Father, thank you that you are an amazing God, that you never cease to amaze us when we stop to look at what you have done and who you are. So I pray, God, that you, the unfathomable, uncontainable, amazing God, that you would come and help us to turn our hearts, to turn our attention to you this morning. Give us eyes to see glorious things and rapture our hearts afresh, O God, with who you are. Do that. Push away all of the distractions and the anxieties and the things that would rob us of having this time with you this morning. So come and work among us. Change us, transform us, God. Expand, increase our capacity to both see and enjoy you in all of your glory. And I pray this in the great eternal name of our Savior, Jesus Christ. Amen. Well, thanks for coming for another installment of our class, Unsurpassed Pleasures. As I mentioned earlier this morning, we're going to be focused on God's pleasure in all his creation. So let me just walk us through quickly what I'm hoping to accomplish in this hour we have together. I want to start just by reflecting for a couple of minutes on what makes a thing pleasurable. I don't know if you've ever asked that question, but I think it's a good question to ask as we go into this. And then we're going to make some preliminary observations about what the universe says about God. And that's where we're going to ask Lynn and John to share a few things with us. So that'll be good. And then I want to examine why God's pleasure in creation is not idolatry, because the assertion we're making in this hour is that God takes great delight in his creation. Not just kind of a hem-ha, you know, that's okay, but he takes great delight. He gets really excited when he looks out on creation and says, yeah, that's good. So why does that not make God an idolater? And then finally, based upon that, I hope that we'll have time to develop then a principle for how to enjoy God's creation. So that's what I'm hoping to do with you this morning. Let's begin then, if you have your notes, and take a few minutes to just reflect on what makes a thing pleasurable. So I want you to think, it doesn't matter what it is, but what is something that you, something in the world, so let's not over-spiritualize this just yet, but what's something in the world that you really enjoy? Okay, so just identify what that is, maybe write it down on your paper if you have short-term memory challenges like me. okay, so you have that idea. What is that thing that you really enjoy? It could be an activity? Maybe it's fishing, or is there a special meal that you really enjoy? Is there a place you like to go? Is there a special pair of socks that you like to wear that give you that holy feeling? I don't know. Anyway, so what is that thing? Okay, you have it? Okay? All right. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to think, why is it that you enjoy that thing? Why? I mean, not everybody probably enjoys that thing the way you enjoy it. So what is it about that thing, whatever it is, that causes you to say, yeah, I enjoy that. I love that. I want to be there or participate or eat that, okay? So, any thoughts? Why do you enjoy that thing? Yeah, Mike.
It's something that my dad and I used to do.
Okay, great. Something that used to do with his dad together. Good. Someone else? Yeah.
The ocean.
The ocean. Okay. So why?
It exhibits the ongoing power of God that's never stopping. Besides, it's beautiful and it smells great.
Okay, so it's beautiful, it smells great, it exhibits that ongoing, never-ending power of God. Yeah?
It would make me happy and peaceful.
It would make you happy and peaceful. Okay?
Right.
All right. Anyone else? Why do you like that thing?
It's exciting.
It's exciting. Okay. What is exciting? Do you want to share what your exciting thing is, or is that private?
A great Seahawks game.
A great Seahawks game. Okay. 10 years ago, the Seahawks had I can say that because I'm a Seahawks fan too, originally from Washington. So, yeah. Okay. So, some things just to watch or even be close to or involved in can create a sense of excitement that we experience. Any other ideas? What is it about that thing that makes it enjoyable? Susan?
It's moving my body in a way that is refreshing and invigorating.
Okay. All right. So it's an opportunity for you to use this body that God has given you to move, and that can be energizing, invigorating. Good. Any other thoughts? Yeah.
It's relaxing.
It's relaxing. Okay, yeah, good. So sometimes we have been doing something that's strenuous or stressful, and so to be in a place or with people or maybe in anticipation of eating certain foods can just bring us to a place of, that's relaxing. You know. Yeah.
It's also mentally stimulating.
Mentally stimulating. So sometimes we want to go somewhere or do something or participate in a thing that's gonna like engage our minds or our hearts. So yeah.
So I like to brew beer.
You like to brew beer?
And it's all of those things. It's creative. It's mentally stimulating. It's relaxing, and I get to engage my mind. Many, many areas of God's creation.
Okay.
All
yeah.
have to work together perfectly in order to generate a good product.
Great.
Well, yeah.
So the activity of brewing beer involves creativity, and it's invigorating, and it's, it involves a lot of different aspects that make that whole experience something that you enjoy, right? And if you enjoy drinking a beer, even better, right? Because you... okay. Well, I wanted to bring that up and then have us think for a minute about something that a Yale professor's name is Paul Bloom. He wrote a book called How Pleasure Works. And I don't necessarily ascribe to everything that he says or writes, but I came across an interview that he did with NPR, and he's talking about the phenomenon of pleasure and what makes things pleasurable to us. And he says these two things, I believe that I put them in your notes. And so just think about this. Do you agree or not with what he has to say about this? So he says, when we get pleasure from something, it's not merely based on what we see or what we hear or what we feel. Rather, it's based upon what we believe that thing to be. For all of us, what makes something art is dependent on our beliefs about how it came into being, not merely its current nature, not merely what it looks like. So he gives an example. They did an experiment. There's a world-renowned violinist whose name is Joshua Bell. And so he plays in great orchestra halls, and lots of people pay lots of money to see this guy play his $3 million Stradivarius violin, right? So he goes down to a Metro DC, and he plays there all day, and people are just walking by him like it's nothing. Here's this guy playing amazing violin music with a $3 million violin, and they're just doing their thing, right? Why? Because they think he's just some chum trying to pull in a little bit of change in his thing, right? They can't imagine that that this is a great violinist. So what they believe, what they assume about who this person is and what he's doing impacts how valuable or what they believe is really taking place right in front of their very eyes, okay? So the idea is what you believe or how you think something came into being or the value you've come to assume that it has will impact the way you experience that thing as pleasurable or not. They also did an experiment with young kids, three-year-old kids. And so they bring out an object, and some of the kids, they say, someone worked really hard to make this object, and it's a piece of art, okay? And so because the kids have been told that this piece of work was created by an artist who put a lot of effort into it, that kid will likely take that object and think, wow, this is a statue. This is something amazing. You take that same object and you tell another kid, well, you know, it just kind of was something that they pulled out of the trash, and they'll treat it like it's basically nothing. It doesn't have much value at all, right? It's because what they believe about how that thing came into being, why it exists, impacts the pleasure that they take in a particular thing. It's not just the thing itself that immediately demonstrates its value or not. Okay, so with that in view, think for a minute. Does that shed light on maybe why you said or value or enjoy the things that you enjoy? So here's an example. Mike said, I enjoy that because it's something I did with my dad, right? So it's not just the thing itself, but it's the fact that that thing is associated with a person and an experience that is valued that makes the continued participation in that something that's valuable. And it may be, they also did studies where, so people would pay big money to buy a sweater that was owned and worn by one of their favorite celebrities, right? Whereas if the same sweater were just being sold off of a store shelf, they would pay $15 for it, you know? And even better if the so-called celebrity sweater had not been washed, right? Because then you sort of get more of the person that comes with the sweater, right? Okay, so it's not just the sweater in and of its own right, but it's what we associate with it, how it came to being, who it was owned by, that gives it a sense of value. So all that to raise the question, what about God? Why does God take pleasure in the things that he takes pleasure in? Specifically, why does God take pleasure in his creation? And so we're going to be looking at that a little bit more. But right now I want us to kind of turn the page a little bit and Take several minutes to think about what the universe tells us about God. And so in your notes, you have kind of two sections. And Lynn's going to share with us here in just a minute about what the universe out there tells us. Okay, just write some observations. We'll come back after both of these guys have shared, and I'm interested to hear what observations you've made. But note observations about what the universe out there is saying, and then when Lynn is done, we'll have John come up and share with us a little bit about that. So, Lynn, are you ready? Where are you? There you are. Come on up. Let's give him a warm welcome on this chilly, rainy day. Thanks, Lynn.
I'm going to start with this. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Day to day, your speech pours out at night, and night to night reveals knowledge. Ever since I was like 4 years old, or in the fourth grade, there I am. Thank God for orthodontists, right? Ever since then, I've been absolutely fascinated by the heavens. There was a guy that lived next door that had a telescope. He invited me over. I looked in, and I saw these little tiny cracks and craters on the moon. It just absolutely freaked me out. And I've just been in love with it ever since. Has anybody ever seen a view like this? Raise your hand if you've seen that view before. You've been in a really, really dark, 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 dark place, and the sky was really, really clear. And this is what you saw. There's a lot out there. And there's a lot of stuff we hear about this. It's like 400 light years away, and this is 2,000 light years away. And we wonder, what does that mean? I mean, how can we wrap our minds around a light year? And so we can tell how far things are because of how God made the world, how God made us. Our brain knows trigonometry. I do not know trigonometry. My brain knows trigonometry. This is part of it. Our eyes are a certain distance apart. So we have binocular vision. We have stereo vision. And because of that, our brain does this calculation inside. So if we had a desk out in front of us with a bunch of things on it, we could go out like this, and our arm or our hand and our fingers would go clomp right onto the object that we wanted to, because we know how far away it is. And that's usually in inches. That's like 18 inches out, or that's 12 inches out. And we can grab those things because of the calculation that our brain does. And what it does, if you can visualize this, you've got the two eyes, draw a line between them. You've got this object out here, draw two lines, each from one eye out to that object. It makes a triangle. That triangle has certain angles and lengths to it. And it's the same thing when we figure out how far things are in space. Now, we use inches here. If we're out walking, we might use feet. If we're watching a football game, we might use yards and miles if we're out driving somewhere. But when we're talking about things this far away, the numbers are so big, we have to use something called a light year. And how we know how far away it is, and this is really, really interesting, because the Earth goes around the sun, we can take a picture of a star or a planet from two different places, really far apart. That's the bottom of the triangle. And then we look at the star that we're looking at way out there, and we draw a line to that, and there's these angles that are made because of that. And then we can draw a line from the middle of the bottom of the triangle up to that thing, and that's how far away it is. And we use light years, like I said. So a light year is an interesting thing. Light goes 186 miles per second. Per second, it goes 186,000 miles. 186,000 miles per second. Let's see here. So in a minute, I have it written down here, light goes 17,160,000 miles in a minute. So, you know, you just keep extrapolating that out. So it goes this far in a year. Anybody want to read that number for me? Who can do it?
5,880,000,000,000.
Yeah, that's right. 5,880,000,000 miles in 1 year is how far light travels. So I'm going to try to get our heads wrapped around how big God made the universe. God is huge. He made some big, big, big stuff. And so as light travels that fast, it takes us 1.3 seconds for light to reflect off the moon and come down to Earth. 1.3 seconds. That's pretty fast. From the sun, light takes about 8.3 minutes to get here to Earth. If we go a little further out, from the sun to Pluto, it takes 5 hours and 40 minutes. So to the end of our solar system, it takes light 8.5 minutes about to travel across that area. Now we go way out to the first star we come to is Alpha Centauri. That's our closest star. It's 4.3 light years away. So that means it takes light 4.3 years from that star to get to us. If we go a little further out, the galaxy that we live in is the, what is it? The Milky Way galaxy is about 100,000 light years across. So it takes light 100,000 years to travel across the galaxy. And it's, remember how fast it's going. It's going really, really, really fast. Then outside of our galaxy, there's our closest friend is the Andromeda Galaxy, and that is 2.5 million light years away. So in between the edge of our Milky Way galaxy to the next galaxy is nothing for 2.5 million light years. So it takes 2.5 million years for that light to get to us. That's pretty amazing. Now I want to correct something that we've been kind of taught inadvertently over the years. There's a lot of things wrong with this, and we've seen things like this in encyclopedias and science books and all over the place for our whole life. The size of those things is completely wrong, and the distances from the sun and from each other is completely wrong. I mean, really, really wrong. So in actuality, if the size of the sun was, say, like a football, or like a basketball, we'll take a basketball, the size of the Earth would be about 2 millimeters. Now, a pencil is about 8 millimeters wide. And so a fourth of a pencil would be the size of the Earth compared to that basketball. The distance it would be away from the basketball is a half a football field. And so if you can visualize the basketball in the end zone and this little tiny speck way out to the 50-yard line, that's how much space that is. And so if you then extrapolate that out, you can see that that's completely off, way off. An encyclopedic page in the book, even if the sun was represented like that, the page would have to be 25 feet, you know, big for it to be represented correctly. So space and size and time, they're really, really big, huge. In fact, traveling as fast as we can now, the International Space Station travels about 17,000 miles per hour, okay? So that would take us about 3 days to get to the moon. Take us about 220 days to get to the sun. I'm not sure why we would want to do that, unless you're Icarus, if you remember Icarus. It'd take us about 3 years at that speed to go to the end of our solar system, to Pluto. And now to the nearest star, it would take about 18,000 years to go to the nearest star. To go across our galaxy would take about 1.6 million years, and to travel to Andromeda would take about 40 million years. Now that's actually, I switched that from the International Space Station to, what's the name of the satellite that's going out to the end of the Voyager 1. Yeah, it's going about 30,000 miles per hour. But even at that speed, it would take us about 40 million years to travel to the next galaxy that's out there. Okay, let's talk about size. I want you to watch this for a minute here and see what this has to say. Does that make you feel a little small? So God made things really huge. I mean, just ginormous. I like that word. In fact, so if we talk about how many Earths would fit into the planet Jupiter, it's about 1,300 Earths would fit into the planet Jupiter, our largest planet in our solar system. That's how big Jupiter is, and you saw the comparison up there. 1.3 million Earths would fit into the Sun. And I have to tell you about this picture. This is a picture that Aaron took from my backyard. This spot right here is actually Venus. So we can compare that, the size of Venus, to the Sun. And it's in between the Earth and Sun with this photograph. And those other dots over there are sunspots. Well, the sunspots are as big as the Earth. And it's just a little dark spot on the Sun. In that largest star that you saw, more than 3 billion of our suns would fit into it. I mean, it's just amazing how large God made things. Absolutely incredible. He made things like this. Isn't that beautiful? That's a nebula. That's the Butterfly Nebula, for obvious reasons, taken with the Hubble Space Telescope. And those colors represent different gases that are in there. Now, the center of that, a star exploded and sent those gases out. That's called a supernova, when a star explodes like that. What's amazing is that's 1.5 light years across. That's how big that is. You remember how big it took light to travel to the end of our solar system? About 4.5 minutes. And that's 1.5 light years across. This is the Orion Nebula. You can actually see this one with your naked eye in a really dark sky if you know where to look. And the Orion Nebula is a little larger. That's 12 light years across. 12 light years across that thing. The Crab Nebula is another exploding star kind of nebula. You can kind of visualize how that happened. And back in 1054, Chinese astronomers noted when this star exploded. It got really, really bright. They noticed that in the sky. It didn't look like that to them, unless they had eyes the size of a, you know, whale. But the star got really, really bright, and then it started dimming down again when the gases spread out. That's what happens with a supernova. But that was actually seen by humans. This is my favorite. This is the Eta Carinae Nebula. This thing is really big. 230 light years across. 230 light years across this thing. And so our whole entire solar system, would be, see this little thing right here? A little cloud? Our entire solar system, the sun and all of the planets would fit within that thing right there. That's how big that cloud is. If you zoom into this cloud over here, see this really bright spot right here? If you zoom into that, like the Hubble can do, it's another star that exploded, and that's what it looks like. What's amazing about this star is they saw it explode in 1837. That's when that star first started to explode. And it took about 4 or 5 years for it to, it got brighter and brighter and brighter, and then it started to dim out. That's just crazy. That's 7,500 light years away from us, and it's about 230 light years wide. Just incredible. Now, other than that, there's more galaxies out there. This is the Andromeda Galaxy. It's the closest one to us that I talked about, taking 2.5 million years for light to travel from that galaxy to our eyeballs. And so in essence, what you're looking at when you see that galaxy, either through a telescope, and you can see that galaxy with your naked eye too if you know where to look. It looks like a little smudge in the sky. But the light that you're seeing is 2.5 million years old. Those things are just amazing to me. These are other galaxies that are out there. Beautiful, fantastic, large, big, huge. I can see why God looks on his creation and says, that is really cool. That is good. That's what God says about it. He just spoke this stuff into existence. And so it makes us feel so tiny and itty-bitty and small. A lot of people would compare this to us compared to an ant. That's actually incorrect. This is us compared to like the molecule on the end of an ant's foot. And so we're really tiny. And what's amazing about the God that made this universe, this huge, huge universe, made us, and he knows us. He knows each one of us. He knows all the hairs on my head and off my head. He knows everything about us. I just wanted to come back to this one where this is a more familiar thing that people have actually seen with their own eyeballs. And the heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaim his handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. But God is really big, and he still loves each one of us. I'm written in his book. My name is in his book. He knows me, and I'm so small. I think God made all of this stuff just for us to discover it and to discover how big and how beautiful he is. He knows each one of us. He created us.
Wow. That just has to make you just go silent in awe before an amazing God. I mean, who can fathom that our God is bigger than all that? I want you to just soak that in, that is our God who spoke that into being. Amazing. God, we give you praise. You are an awesome God. Your creativity never ceases to amaze us. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to look upon these things and to be stunned and exhilarated. Praise be to your name. Yeah, that's good. Well, it doesn't stop there. That's just one piece, a big piece. But now we're going to get to hear for a few minutes from John. He's going to share about weather. That's something we maybe more tangibly interact with on a day-to-day basis. But there are wonders even in that. So John, come and share with us. Thanks.
You might recall a line in the gospel: who is this that even the wind and the seas obey him? And after Jesus had calmed the storm, and it's the same God that created the universe, Lynn was showing us on the big scale. I first got interested in weather, I can't really remember a time I wasn't, but when I was 9 years old growing up in southern Oregon, the Rogue River flooded. It wasn't conditions totally unlike lately. A lot of low elevation snow, and then a warmer rain came in, melted a lot of snow and made the Rogue River flood to, in a lot of rivers down here from what I understand now. I wasn't aware then. But anyway, it was just a major flood. We built an entire treehouse at my grandma's house on the Rogue River out of stuff that floated up on her property. I remember even as a 9-year-old, seeing chicken coops and sheds and stuff, big trees, logs floating down the river. It's pretty amazing. And it's usually something me and my cousin could almost throw a rock across. And when it was at flood stage, it was like 300 yards across and 60 feet deep, probably from where it usually was. Anyway, that got me interested in weather, and I always kind of kept an eye on it. But I, there's so many different topics we could talk about. We'll take a look here, just a few basic principles that God has designed into how he makes weather work. We all know the term wind. That's considered typically horizontal air movement. There are rising and sinking air currents. We don't usually refer to that as the wind. It's the horizontal movement, or at least parallel to the Earth's surface, can go up and over mountains. That's all wind. But as you might or might not know, wind tends to move from higher toward lower pressure. It's kind of like it's trying to alleviate an imbalance, bring the lower pressure up and the higher pressure down. It's always, but because it's a continual, ongoing, large area process, it doesn't always get to that goal. It's just working towards it. But even on different scales, large scale, small scale, and medium, wind has a force on it, or the air has a force on it that we call wind, or as it moves, higher to lower pressure. You might ask, well, what is air pressure? If you were to take a column, like say the size of me, all the way to the top of the atmosphere, that is called the air pressure. No matter what size at the surface, at the bottom of that, the weight of everything above it is the pressure. If you go up on a high mountain, you still have pressure, but you have less atmosphere above you, don't you? So you have a lower pressure, a less pressure. There's less air above you. And so that's what, at any given place, determines the air pressure. And you might recall from your school days, was it 14.7 pounds per square inch? So even though the atmosphere seemed like there's nothing to it, just a square inch all the way up to the top, it's going to weigh almost 15 pounds. They measure it in aviation in inches of mercury, around 30 inches in a column of mercury, and that's how they make good barometers, accurate barometers to measure the air pressure. Third one there, the air that is warmer than its surroundings is going to tend to rise. I'm sure Sean knows as much about any of this as I do. Being a helicopter pilot, these kind of things are very important to aviation. So as it rises, the air begins to expand because it's got lesser pressure around it. Remember, as you go up, pressure's getting less. So as something rises, it's expanding. And expansion, just physical law that God has put into place, leads to cooling. It's just the opposite of compressional warming. Any of you know about motors and stuff and pistons and cylinders, compressional warming. And the opposite is expansional cooling. You ever notice when you blow up a balloon at a birthday party and it gets away from you and flutters around the room and you grab it, it's cold? That's because all that air that was in it expanded out real quick when it came through the nozzle in it for a short time there. It's very cold. That's expansional cooling that you can feel. But anyway, as air rises, it expands and it cools. And another fact, another way that works, air's capacity to hold water vapor gets smaller as the air gets cooler, or it gets a greater capacity as the air gets warmer. That's just another fact. And I say capacity, it doesn't mean warm air always has a lot of water in it, but it has a capacity to hold a lot of water. And in fact, a lot of it does hold quite a bit. The tropical oceans are really the greatest source of moisture getting from the water base, which is mainly the oceans, up into the atmosphere. A lot of the clouds that we see at mid-latitudes up here wouldn't be here if it wasn't for all the evaporation going on between 20 north and 10 and 20 south down in the equatorial regions. That warm body of water and the sunshine evaporation, that's where a great share of the moisture gets up into the air, and we call that water vapor. And there's water vapor in this room. I want to make sure everybody understands, water vapor is not what you see. That's condensed water when you see fog or drops like outside today. That's liquid water. Water vapor is the invisible, it's just another gas in the air, or component of the air, and it's invisible until, as long as it's what we call relative humidity is below, or the air is below 100%, and then at that point, we call that saturation, or we get condensation, water turning from vapor into liquid. So anyway, rising air expands, the expansion leads to cooling, and as it goes up and that cooler air gets to where it can't hold as much moisture, it's got a lesser capacity, its relative humidity is rising as it comes up, and pretty soon that's going to lead, if there is enough moisture, to condensation. And that's when clouds form. You ever notice how a lot of times on a sunny day, all the cloud bases are level, but the tops, you know, different cumulus clouds are puffing up taller than other ones, but the bases are fairly level. That's what we call the LCL, the lifting condensation level. Everything rose up, and in that air mass, given in that area, it all hit condensation about the same height because it had the same amount of moisture, rose up, driven by the sun's heat a lot of times, or convergence into a low-pressure center will raise up heat. So anyway, that's if you can follow those sequence of events, you understand quite a bit to know about what there is about forecasting weather in terms of precipitation chances or not. You're looking for areas of rising air that has moisture in it, and convergence into low pressure is kind of on the mid-scale, the 100 to 1,000-mile scale. horizontally to raise air up and cause storms like we've been seeing lately. But we're going to take a look here at, there's so many things we could talk about, but in a short time, we'll hone in on one. Thunderstorms, lightning, and hail, they all kind of go together. There's a picture of a, I believe that's actually in southern Alberta or Saskatchewan, one of those southern prairie parts of Canada, the big severe thunderstorm on the left. The lightning picture is down, I think that's Albuquerque, New Mexico, under a nighttime lightning event. And then you can see that hail sometimes gets bigger than the quarter inch to pea-size, nickel-size stuff we sometimes get here. I think the biggest I've heard of in my 40 years in Reading is about an inch, inch and a quarter maybe. And that's pretty darn rare, but that is plenty to damage things. Because it's not only just falling, it's accelerating when it comes down, and hailstones can hit the ground with quite a speed sometimes. But let's look at some details a little bit. You see a couple scriptures there from Job, remember? After all the questioning, and God speaks back to Job and says, okay, I've heard you out, but listen to me, you know? And let's get things back in perspective on who's God and who's man. And that's a couple of the things he said. God seemed to uses weather quite often for all sorts of reasons, good and sometimes bad from our perspective. But he's got a purpose for it. In one of those scriptures there, he even says he uses it for battle and war, and we can think of scriptures in the Bible and stories in the Bible where God certainly used weather in a big and powerful way. But in thunderstorms, a few facts, you need those three things: moisture, low-level moisture, or sometimes mid-level. We get high-base thunderstorms here in the summertime because it's so darn dry and hot down near the surface. But typically, let's think like in a Midwest thunderstorm, a severe thunderstorm where cold Canadian air has met Gulf of Mexico warm air, and you get that big clash of air masses and the strong lifting. You need those three kind of things. There are, at any given time, right now, around the Earth, different parts of the day at different places, 1,800 thunderstorms are happening. A typical thunderstorm has about 275 million gallons of water in it, liquid water or hail, liquid or frozen water. The air temperature in a lightning channel, we call it a lightning flash or lightning strike, is about 50,000 degrees Fahrenheit, which is actually for the surface of the sun. It's five times hotter than the sun's surface, but only for a brief instant. And what happens is when God sends that electricity in that channel, the air, it happens so rapidly, the air expands to a super degree, super fast because of that 50,000 degrees, and then it contracts. That is what initiates the sound called thunder. And if you've ever been real close to a thunderstorm, you don't hear that low rumble. You hear a very sharp crack. I mean, it scares you, and it'll make you jump. That's the actual initiation of thunder. And then as it goes out and diffuses and turbulence mixes it and stuff, it can sound different ways, but it has that loud, super loud crack when you're right near it. And that's because of that expansion and contraction to such a great degree in such a short time. God's power is amazing. The updrafts in thunderstorms, and now a thunderstorm, I haven't really mentioned it yet, but in that, it's much smaller than a big weather system, you know, like we have winter storms that you see a front on the satellite picture on TV, and it's 1,000 miles long or 400 or 500 miles, little curly Q coming in, spinning counterclockwise with a frontal band and rain and snow ahead of it. Thunderstorm, as you know, are 2 to 20 miles across, depending on their size. And we have the kind out here, they build up, they stay fairly vertical, and pretty soon the downdraft that develops overwhelms the updraft, and you got to have the updraft to have that continual conversion and what's called the latent heat of condensation. Heat is being given off as the process of condensation occurs, and as it rises up, that gives it buoyancy, and that's what makes a thunderstorm build like a big cauliflower cloud. As long as you see that going on, it's still in the active building stage, and there's air rising in it. But at some point on these air mass thunderstorms like we typically have in the West, and it only takes a lot of times 20 to 40 minutes, then the updraft gets cut off, the downdraft overwhelms, and you get your rain and your hail if you're going to get any out of it, and that ends it. But a big severe thunderstorm, because of wind shear, stronger winds aloft than there is at the surface, maybe 20 miles an hour down here, 50 or 60 up here, that makes a tilt to the thunderstorm, and it keeps the updraft separate from the down, the precipitation. A lot of times they're side by side, so the updrafts can get much stronger. And we see these big hailstones, like in that last picture on the right, super big hailstones. You would have had to have an updraft around 100 miles an hour straight up or on a tilt up to cause hail. Hail actually a lot of times makes a lot of cycles up and down in within a cloud, and it gathers more moisture and frozen volume to it as it does that. And eventually it gets outside whatever was lifting it and falls, or the thing collapses and it falls. So it's pretty amazing. And you can see in the picture there was some baseball to grapefruit size hail in that bucket. Guy needed two hands, or whoever that was holding that needed two hands to hold the one hailstone. And due to time, and just pick a few, this is my last slide. We'll close with a few weather records. Some of you that are into weather probably know some of these. Hottest ever, and they used to say it was in Libya worldwide, but it's actually, they found that was probably in air, the way that was taken. But actually Death Valley, right here in California, holds the record for the hottest temperature on Earth, 134.2, I think it is. Coldest, and that may not even be accurate, in 83 it was, Vostok, Antarctica. It's a Russian station down there. But minus 129 degrees, 128.5. It might be in the 129s now. I think I read of something superseding that. A few miscellaneous, quite random USA records. 24-hour rainfall, 42 inches. So picture in 24 hours from the floor like that. This happened in Alvin, Texas. It's down near the Gulf Coast. It's where Nolan Ryan, the baseball pitcher, has a ranch. That's what I remember about it as a kid. Just to think how much rain that was. 1 year snowfall, Mount Baker ski area. That's only 4,100 feet, but you're almost to the Canadian border up there. So it's pretty cold air masses. And that looks like an El Nino winter, 98, 99. We were very wet down here in California, but fairly mild. But up there, they were cold enough with all that moisture to get 95 feet. So you went outside and looked at the building from the outside, maybe three times taller than this building is the depth of snow that fell. It didn't get quite that deep on the ground, but that's how much snow fell in that calendar year. Strongest wind, 231 miles an hour at Mount Washington, New Hampshire. And that's not a tornado. I'm saying strongest non-tornado wind. There are winds in tornadoes which are hard to measure because of their strength and putting an instrument and still finding it there when the thing goes through. But there are winds probably exceeding 300 miles an hour in some tornadoes. But straight line winds, it's kind of like the jet stream surface there on Mount Washington in 1934. Largest hailstone. Oh, and that's actually been beaten. There's some place in Australia or Tasmania that's got a higher wind max than that now. Largest hailstone, about 8 inches in diameter, or at least in its longer diameter, and weighed nearly 2 pounds, 1.9 some pounds. Vivian, South Dakota, and that's only 13 years ago. In the least humid city, if you're looking for a dry place to move to, Sin City, Las Vegas, Nevada. So anyway, God is so amazing. There's so much we could say about weather. I'm not trying to teach a whole class here, and I know we're running out of time. So anyway, thanks for your time, and God is awesome.
Wow. I just am in awe of what God does, that he can make float millions and billions of gallons of water from someplace thousands of miles away so that we can drink water and grow plants and, you know, have animals and go skiing and do all the things we do. And next week we'll get into this a little bit more. We'll continue on with this lesson plan. But that wasn't just like, oh, that was an accident. That's cool. You know, it's not like God sort of said, oh, let's create a universe and then figured out how cool it was after the fact. This is by design. I hope you guys wrote some observations. I want to solicit some of that back from you, but I'll just share a couple of things briefly. Lived in Minnesota for 5 years in Minneapolis, and we got lots of thunderstorms there. We spent a lot of hours down under our stairwell in our basement as the thunderstorms and tornadoes went overhead. Interestingly enough, in that area, I don't know if it's true everywhere, but in that area, where we have tornadoes quite often, which is a fairly narrow, one mile wide, you know, bigger or smaller, fairly narrow stretch. But the most damage is done by thunderstorms. The force of the winds coming down and pushing out from these thunderstorms blow trucks over, send furniture, your patio furniture through your door. So we fear a lot about tornadoes, but it's actually those sheer winds of thunderstorms that are amazingly powerful. I mean, when they hit, it's just, you can't believe the force of it. When Brenda and I were first married, we lived in a little duplex in Anderson, and there was this amazing thunderstorm happening. Lightning was cracking everywhere, so we went out, and we were just in awe of the lightning and stuff going over and the cracks of thunder. And so we're sitting out there in the chair in our backyard, and some of our neighbors were doing the same thing. And all of a sudden, this crack of lightning. I mean, I thought it was 2 feet in back of it. Brenda and I both hopped into each other's arms. talk about being scared in a moment, you know. It got our attention, you know. And it turned out it was probably a couple blocks away, had hit a tree in that neighborhood, and fried it pretty good. But wow, God is able to get our attention, isn't he? With what he can do with weather by his design. So I wish we could spend 10 or 20 weeks just looking at the wonders of God's creation. It's unfortunate that we can't. But what did you observe? So we've heard about, you know, big, huge universe, and we've heard about weather. So what do these things say about God? Some preliminary observations that you might bring from what we've been talking about. Yeah?
It's way beyond our understanding.
Way beyond our understanding. Okay, good. Yeah.
He uses weather in so many ways all the time to remind people of himself, whether they're Christians or not. Unbeliever, when they get that lightning crack near them, they're going to think about God a little bit.
Yeah, okay. So he uses weather to get the attention both of believers and unbelievers, right? Yeah, so good. Dan.
Yeah, I thought of Psalm 8, 3 and 4. When I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him, the son of man that you care for him?
Okay. Good. So Psalm 8, 3, and 4, and you look at all of the wonders of what God has done, and then it's like, you know, Lynn talked about that little speck that we are, just the earth, and then the billions of people that are like the molecule on the end of the ant's foot, and yet what? God knows us, that little speck. God knows us intimately. That's amazing. That's unfathomable that God would take such interest and delight. It would be like me staring at an ant and watching its foot twitter, wiggle, and just like care about that. I mean, and that's not even to scale, right? But that's our God. Yeah. What else? Yeah.
It's a pretty strong rebuke for me when I have the audacity to ask God for a sign.
Okay.
And it's pretty obviously, I mean, Jesus talks about the rocks crying out if we hold our tongue. But like,
yeah.
Obviously all of creation is
yeah.
Shouting. No, duh, God did this. Who are you?
Yeah, great. Okay. So as we are envisioning these things, participating in them, encounter them, it should be something of a rebuke when we're saying like, God, show me something. Like, God, you know, help me believe. You know, it's like he's shown us a little bit, right? Yeah, good. What else, Ryan?
I was listening to John, and I mean, he's using words that he thinks are normal and simple words. And I'm like, oh, wow. Oh, I think I understood what he meant. And I hear that when I hear engineers talk, or all, you know, people who are specialized, who spend years of their life to know a thing, and to think that there are 100,000 things like that, which God didn't just understand, but he made them, he built them, right? Like, all those things he was saying in that time, when I was like, that's amazing, I never even thought about weather like that, or
yeah.
I don't know
yeah.
how buildings hold themselves up, or, you know, he's like, yeah, I did that.
Yeah. So just to summarize what Ryan said, so as he's listening to John, there's lots of vocabulary, lots of understanding, and that's just like one little piece of what God designed. And there are thousands, maybe billions of different spheres of understanding that God designed and then brought into the orbit or brought into operation in his creation. And it's like, wow, like that's our God, really? That's our God. I mean, honestly, when John was talking, it's like, I'm going to have to research that because I thought kind of like the opposite of some things about air expanding and cooling and stuff. That was like, so I'm like, I'm obviously still don't even understand some basics of that. So, yeah, the understanding of God is amazing. Well, I know there's a lot more that you all could share. I hope you go home and share it with your wives and grandkids and coworkers and just have an opportunity to say, wow, what an amazing universe we live in. What an amazing God we are privileged to know and love. But we're out of time, and so I'm going to pray for us, and we'll pick things up again next week. Lord, thank you for this hour together. I have just been moved to awe of you. You never cease to amaze me, God. Help us to live with you in view as we consider these things. Use this time, God, I pray, to in the hours and days and weeks to come, use what we've heard and thought about this morning to cause our delight and pleasure in you to ramp up significantly. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.